Let's give him a big hand.
Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tom. Or TK, whatever. Half the people call me Tom, half the people call me TK, and they ask me, what do you want to be called? I said, anything but what I used to be called, I'll tell you that. First, I want to do my propers and thank the committee for asking me to come down and speak at your 10th annual Fall Fest. You're into double digits now. That's a wonderful that you're still doing the work for the community for this stuff. Still suffering alcoholic. And thank you, Mike, for asking me to come down. And I want to thank my friend Chuck, who will be down this morning. We come down here, we left at 6:30 in the morning, and I figured, you know, it'd take us 2.5 hours. And we got here 1 hour and 20 minutes. Looking for a restaurant. There are no restaurants in Tracy. The way we came anyway. But then we finally found a place, and we got here. Before I start, I would like to say that my home group, which is the Steps to Freedom group, Monday night in San Rafael, that my home group sends its love to your group here, and it's a privilege to be here. And I've been a member of that group just over last February. That group was formed, my mistake, that group was formed in 78. My late wife started that group, and she made me the secretary, so I've been with that group every Monday night since that time. And I have a sponsor. I hear people say that now. I have a sponsor, and he's got many years of sobriety, and he got sober in New York, and he was one of the guys that actually did play poker with Bill Wilson on Saturday nights back in New York, and long time sober. And it's sort of nice because AA is still young enough, as you know, where we still have skin on our history, and there are still people around that were there. So it's not like we have to listen to 1,000 years of translation. And it's still one drunk talking to another drunk, and the original people were there. So I like to pick on my sponsor's memory, and I asked him, you know, what were the rooms like? You know, what was the literature? He said, we didn't have any literature, you know. And he said, well, what'd you guys read? He said, all we had was two books. We had the big book, and we had the Sermon on the Mount. That's all we had. And so, you know, little tidbits of information, you know, and I asked him about Bill, and I'd say, you know, everybody has sort of a favorite thing in AA, whether it's working with newcomers or doing H&I or that kind of thing, you know. And I'd ask, you know, what was Bill's favorite thing? What was his thing? You know, and I said, well, Bill had three things, you know. He says, no dirty talk from the podium. He didn't like that. And he didn't like that. He said, leave the women alone. He didn't like that. And everything around for the newcomer. He's talked to the newcomer. So I try to emulate that a little bit. And I try to think about, heard a guy say from the podium one time, you know, that I'm up here to talk to somebody who's new. And the rest of you can sit here quietly and be polite, because I'm going to talk to the new guy. I always like to start with a thought just to center myself. On page 43 of the big book, I saw page 47, the last paragraph, which says, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. And I always recite that line, because after I got to the program and I got a sponsor and he encouraged me to read the big book, and I was still so foggy that nothing would stick, nothing. And I read that line about probably the 10th time, and my mind paused there. And it was the first line that resonated with me. At certain times, the alcoholic had no effective mental defense against the first drink. And it started to seep in. I had heard in the room that it was this disease concept, you know, but I couldn't put that together until those bits and pieces around those pages in the big book, 35 through 47, started to resonate for me. And because I was matching my experience to the words in the big book, and it was the first time that I was able to relate to a point where I said, yeah, that's what happened to me, that's what happened to me. I'll get to that a little bit later, but a little background. I'm a Bay Area boy. I was raised in Oakland and moved to San Francisco to Hunters Point when I was around 4. And I remember when I was a little kid about that time, my dad took me down to the Hunters Point shipyard, and I think it was the USS Hornet, if I'm not mistaken. I had just come back from the Pacific, and the bow of the ship was all blown out from the kamikaze, and those are my earliest memories. And we lived there, and it was a shipyard town. And a lot of people from the Midwest had moved out for the war effort and whatever, and it was a sort of a almost a Midwestern folksy kind of a faith-based ethic, you know, howdy neighbor kind of thing, you know, and we're going to go to the picnic, you know, I want you kids to come with us. And it was that kind of a, like I like to think of a wholesome Plains kind of a, you know, ethic mentality around there at the time, as I remember. And it wasn't integrated yet. And so shortly after that, people moved back home, or they moved out of the neighborhood, and the work slowed down, and they integrated in 1955, and I was a teenager at that time. The setting at home is that my folks were two deaf-mute people, and they lived in their silent world, and they raised four hearing kids. And I like to think of that as mom and dad. It was like herding snakes, for God's sakes. You know, we were everywhere. And they were poor. They were dirt poor. And for years, I thought I was affected by that. And I started getting in trouble, you know, when they integrated all the races together, you know, all of a sudden, you know, teenagers being what they are, you know, very self-centered people. Hostility was coming out, so there was a lot of trouble there. So I got out of there just in time before it got too crazy, and they moved into the regular white neighborhood, if you will. And then that's when I really started to notice the difference of myself and the rich kids, as I called them. You know, they had matching socks and lunch buckets, and they had all those kind of things, and I had hand-me-down rags. So I started to feel the differences and internalizing those differences, and no one really to talk to about it, didn't know that I could talk to anybody about it. So, and it was just about that time I discovered alcohol, and it was a magic elixir that served me well. And I've heard 1,000 descriptions of that effect, and for me it was, it made me feel extremely secure inside. And the only other security I could relate that to was that when I was even younger. This is about 15 or 16 when I started drinking. And when I was younger, the only security I'd know when I got scared or something bothered me was to run to mama, you know, and mama would pick you up in her arms and hold you tight, pat you on the back and say that everything would be okay, you know, it was just a chicken, you know, or whatever it was that scared me. And so that was the only real security I knew, was mama love. And then when I started becoming adolescent, you start to break away from the family ties and influences, and you start to develop your own personality and fears and everything else. And when I found alcohol, it gave me that same sense of security. And I adopted a lifestyle, as people have said from the podium, that I could let go and let booze. And so I did, because when I was drinking, life just become much, much easier. You know, I wasn't so concerned about being skinny, and I wasn't concerned about having big ears and not having the proper clothes and not having this or that and all that kind of stuff. So it became very, very easy. And not knowing that, you know, that I was, quote, what we call an Alcoholics Anonymous, selfish and self-centered, I didn't know that. And being adolescent, and during the adolescent years, you're supposed to be self-centered. That's the nature of adolescence. As we're moving from childhood, go through adolescence into maturity, and you're supposed to be self-centered. And myself, until I was 40, and I've seen my 13-year-old daughter, and she just couldn't get her face out of that mirror, and I have to laugh at her, and I said, you know, I do the same thing without the mirror. And it's just the nature of the being. So this alcohol placated all that, and I felt very, very comfortable. But being a wise guy, I had my own agenda as far as how to go through school and life. By this time, I had gotten a car, and that gave me mobility to get out into other neighborhoods and friends and all that. So I had a better idea how to educate myself, and it wasn't through the structured idea that the school department had. It was my idea of not taking home books and homework assignments and all that, and my idea was to be a little hip-slick and cool and manipulative and lie, cheat, and steal and tap dance and do everything I could, but I never took the books and the material home trying to get the information into my head to enhance my own future. You know, being a wise guy, I gave up a thing called education, which is a powerful thing to throw away. But I snuck through, you know, and I went to work in a men's clothing store in San Francisco, and for the first time, I was making a little bit of money, and I was just 18, 19 years old, and a little bit of money meant, you know, a car, and I could date, and I was dressed to the nines because I had all my clothes were. It was a very, very popular place to be, so I was really looking good, and the one gimmick that I had to get through life with personality. You know, I like to think that the good Lord gives everybody a little something to get through life, you know, whether it's intelligence or brawn or good looks or humility or whatever it is. But I think everybody gets a little something, and my gimmick was personality. I was always a spark plug kind of a guy, you know, and never felt like a stranger in a room full of people, and it was very, very simple for me. So with that one skill in the world, I went back to City College, and I'd like to say that I finally matured enough to realize that there was still an education to be had here, but I had no idea vocationally what I wanted to be, and so I went to the natural, easy thing, which was the social life. And at that time, the fraternities were the big thing to get into, so I got into the fraternities and did quite well there as far as, you know, Freddy Frat Rat and, you know, popularity and all that kind of stuff. And in a short time, I was president of the fraternity and man on campus and a legend in my own mind kind of a thing, you know. And met the right little girl. So at that time, at 19 years old, you know, as far as I was concerned, I had arrived and I had made the astute, immature deduction of what life was all about. And as I saw it, what I was supposed to do was I was supposed to cultivate my circumstances, and my circumstances are from my skin out. And that included where I worked and where I lived and my social situation, my financial situation, and my sexual situation. And that was to use my skills and my talents to enhance those things, and obviously the bigger that those are, the better I'd feel. So that's a philosophy that says if my outsides are okay, then my insides will be okay. And what I didn't know until many, many years later in this program, that there was a sixth thing to be considered, and that's called my spiritual dimension. And that's who I am from skin in. And I can carve that up into my character, my ethics, and my values, and my integrities, and those kinds of things. And I never knew that in order to process life properly, that I had to consult that spiritual thing. And so I was going through life just using my head intellectually. And I never knew that I had this disease of alcoholism, and I was drinking pretty heavily then, and as time went on, I was not progressing vocationally, but I was doing quite well socially, and I was watching my friends move on with their careers. They'd go on to the university, or they'd go to work in some company or dad's business, or they were getting married, and the picket fences and the kids and all that was starting to happen. And meanwhile, the fraternity crowd had moved into a few established neighborhoods in the city, you know, the bar hangouts that we had, and the party was just roaring up, you know, and it was a good time, and I thought that everything was just did real quite well, you know, I had all of what I considered success at the time, you know. I was well liked, and I had a place to live, which was with mom and dad. I'm still sponging off mom and dad, never gave them a dime, and had a girlfriend, and she was popular, so my little world was content. And I didn't know I had this disease called alcoholism, which was to be more progressive, as we know. And I don't get into all the medical ramifications and manifestations of this disease, and I simply call alcoholism Al. And Al is a 600-pound gorilla that lives up here. And when he decides to drink, he drinks. He just comes out of the cage and he drinks, and he just takes me with him. Hence the line on page 47, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. When Al decides to drink, he drinks. And I have no defense against that process. And so it started to get complicated about that time. And it got complicated in small ways in the beginning. You know, I started to recognize that, you know, I was a wise guy, self-willed runner, riot, and I was dragging my car through my neighborhoods. And if there were inconvenient stop signs, I'd run them over and knock them down because I didn't want them there, kind of thing, you know. And so that grew into my attitudes on the job. I'd take my attitude to work. And that was, you know, the boss would sit me down and he'd say, hey, listen, he said, most people go to lunch and then come back, you know, and I'd start drinking and I didn't come back. And it wasn't a Monday, Friday kind of thing. It was any time I wanted. And then the small bills that I was starting to incur, you know, that they were starting to call me for that, you know, and then friends were pulling me aside. And I started getting those little conversations where guys were saying, you know, you touch my wife or my girlfriend again, and I'll bust your ass, you know. And bartenders are after me now because I have a tab everywhere, and my big shotism is not as big as my appetite. And so I'm starting to get in that kind of a trouble. And then before I knew it, it got to be pretty messy, where I was getting fired from jobs, and then I found myself in court before the judge, and And I'm in that place now where I'm raging at the world because everybody's making decisions about my life. And women are throwing me out, and employers are throwing me out, and friends are throwing me out, and bartenders are throwing me out, and my friends are joining the yacht club by this time, and they're moving along, and they're ashamed to bring me along to my they liked me, I was a nice guy, TK, you're a great guy, but when you're drunk, we can't handle you, you know, kind of thing, and I wasn't invited to go to the clubs, and I was becoming excluded from a lot of things, and then the police found me attractive, and they were inviting me in, and the judges were inviting me even deeper in, and I was supposed to be in the Naval Air Reserves over here in Alameda, but that required that I make a commitment, like 400 other guys that put their hand in the air, and they made a commitment to their country that they would do this thing for, you know, after the 6 months, for one weekend a month, they would go over there and serve their country. And I went to Memphis, Tennessee for 6 months, but that was just another drunken thing. And there was a two-week period where we were in the barracks and sort of confined there, and we couldn't get the alcohol. But, you know, the alcoholic being resourceful as he is, I happened to be bunking with a guy in the bunk above me, and they told us that we had to either join some church group to go to on Sunday or KP and peel potatoes. Well, I didn't have a religion, so this guy was Jewish, and he happened to mention, I said, what do you do there? And he said, well, we have our services, and after our services, we have a little social. And I said, what's that? What's the social? And he said, well, he said, the congregation gets together, and we just visit and chit-chat, and we have a glass of wine, and I became Jewish. And, so I was Jewish. I wasn't Jewish, and I went to the Jewish services for 3 weeks and embarrassed myself and my friend, you know, because I went there and the people were sitting there and they weren't drinking their wine. I'd reach over, are you having this meeting? Before they could answer, I'd slug it down, you know, and just making a fool of myself. And that's the alcoholism, you know, just the coming out. Anyway, those stories go on and on and on. And then finally I didn't go to, I stopped going to the military altogether. I didn't go for 4 years when I was supposed to go. I didn't go to my job. I didn't honor any commitments with social commitments with friends. I didn't pay any bills. I didn't give my mom and dad a dime. And all this goes to who I am. It goes to my lack of values and my lack of standards and my lack of ethics. And I just was not a stand-up guy. I was not packing the weight. And I was drinking more and more, and I was getting in more and more in trouble. And a young lady was working one night a week in a bar. You know, she was just a cocktail waitress. So she worked in the bank, but one night a week she went in there for extra bucks. She didn't drink or anything. And I'd go in there with my razzle-dazzle BS. And so she thought that, you know, that she had a good man on her hands, if she could keep me away from the booze and my friends. Just that time, the military activated me. They found me, and they scooped me up, and they sent me to... they had to make an example of the slackers, you know, to tighten up the troops. So they got guys like me. There were two or three of us that were in my situation who just didn't care, didn't honor the commitment, who couldn't stand up to it anyway, and to make examples of us. And they sent me to Vietnam via San Diego. I went to San Diego for 2 months to prepare for the ship. And they put me on the USS Kitty Hawk. And during that 2 months, this lady followed me down, and we got married. I knew her for 2 months. I was married for 30 days. And they put me on the ship, and they sent me away for a year. And that trip consisted of from San Diego to Hawaii to the Philippines to Hong Kong to Japan and that same way back. And the only reason I mentioned that is that I got married 30 days later, the ship left, and I got to Hawaii, and I drank and I whored. And we went to the Philippines, and I drank and I whored. And then I went to Japan, and I drank and I whored. And I went to Hong Kong, and I drank and I whored. And in between those destinations on the ship, I drank, but I didn't whore. That I know of, anyway. And what that speaks to, once again, is it speaks to my lack of integrity. It speaks to my lack of understanding of the vows, which I think are probably the biggest words you can say to another human being. And I valued nothing. And I tore that. I tore those commitments apart. I never sent that woman a dime. I was making good money at sea, and I worked next to a guy who was sending everything, his hazardous duty pay and his sea pay and his regular pay, and he was sending everything home to his wife, and I never sent that woman a dime, you know. And I called her once from Japan. It cost me $200. I was drunk on a spouse, and she just cried on the telephone, and I hung up after $200 of her blubbering, and I, you know, and all I could do was call her names and wasted my $200. And so when I got back, there she was. She was waiting for me. She was interested in the business of marriage and the commitment that people make to one another to go through this thing called life, sharing the good times and the bad times, and maybe trying to pound out a couple of dreams and maybe raise some kids or buy a house or whatever. And I couldn't do that because I drank. And because at certain times, this alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. And when it's time to drink, I drink. And inside I tried to rationalize, and blaming people, places, and things, and but you don't understand and all that. But there was a powerful shame, because I knew that I wasn't packing the weight. And my brothers and sisters were just doing fine, and they were moving up the economic scale and the vocational scale and raising their families, and they were doing honorable things, and I just couldn't pack the weight. So after a short time of 3.5 years of marriage, after I came back and absolutely not supporting that woman in any possible way, mostly spiritually, she was an intelligent, fine woman, and she made the commitment to divorce. She was like a fawn in a forest fire, and she didn't know what to do with a practicing alcoholic, so she made the only logical decision that she could make for survival was to get the hell out. So she did, and that's what I needed, was the final rationale, how could she leave after all I'd done for her, she used to be my big joke from the podium, was that I considered myself a model husband. And if you look up the word model in the dictionary, it says it's a small imitation of the real thing, And that's exactly what I was. I wasn't packing the weight or supporting that woman or doing or bringing anything to the party. I was a taker and a user. And so she left, and after that, I said, screw it. My whole life I've been busting my ass, and I haven't got two nickels to rub together. And because of this, and the educational system, my parents were deaf mute, my dad was a lousy role model, and he was just a little tiny guy, and all he did was go to work and come back. And how am I supposed to learn how to be an aggressive male in the world? And because I had taken a little psych, a little soci, and I had a couple of buzzwords, that I'd throw around. And you always find somebody in the bar who wants to listen to your sad story as long as you're going to buy the drink and be the big shot, And I would tell them all about my family, and they said, oh, yeah, Jesus, And so I was really particularly on my dad. I laid it pretty heavy on him. And anyway, shortly after that, I decided the world don't work. I don't like the way it works, so I made a conscious decision to go to the streets. And so that's what I did. I became a bum south of Market Street in San Francisco, and I let my hair go down over my shoulders, and I thought I was going to be a hippie, because I missed the hippie thing because I was in the bars. So I decided that was my, so I got a sequin cape and I went to the streets that way thinking that I was a hippie and what I was a wino is what I was, anyway, that crazy life went on for almost 4 years out there. And if you've been there, you know what that's about. And if you haven't been there, God bless you. Anyway, there's a lot of stories on the street, most of them pathetic. And the result of that was that I got worse. And I got into that world of oblivion, where you just didn't. I'd stand on the street and I'd look that way and I'd look that way and I'd look up and I'd look down. And I had no purpose, I had no reason to walk in any direction. It was just limbo. It was just limbo. And I was urine stained and Maddie and wine stores, and one of the worst fights I ever got into in my life, before, during, and after, was with a parking meter. And I lost big. I really hurt myself, Anyway, it was about that time, I guess, the guy upstairs smiled, and a friend of mine found me, and a guy I went to junior high school with all the way through, and he was my drinking buddy, and he was my pal, and we would get each other jobs, and we would share jobs and cars and money and apartments and women and whatever, And he was my drinking buddy, and Jimmy's drinking took him through the courts, and he got sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he found me, because he was a shy, timid guy, and he still remembered me as the rah-rah fraternity party buster guy, and he wanted to go in on my shirt tails, so he asked me if I'd go with him, and that's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, was to take Jimmy, who needed it, for God's sake, And that was on February the 15th of 1976, the 21st in Wawona Group in San Francisco. And I walked in there, and as I described myself. I was a mess. That was a couple of weeks after that. I found my way to San Rafael, and I was in the Alana Club, and there was a couple of old timers back in the back room, sitting in the back of the room, and you know, Bernie and Brandy and Boxcar Jack and these kind of guys, and I'd sit between those guys, and they'd say, "Welcome to the yellow tennis shoe set." Think about it. And for me, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't much thought process, there wasn't much measuring, there wasn't evaluation going on. There was an absolute acceptance, for whatever reason. And I just had that sense that I had found something, and something intuitively told me that I had found the brass ring and you better hang on to this thing. And I didn't understand it, I didn't know what it was, but it was what it was. The attractiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous was the open hands, the people that came up generously, you know, and they would reach out and touch me. They would shake my hand, they would pat me on the back, they'd grab my arm, they'd walk me over to the literature table, put their arm around me, you know, see if I needed a couple of bucks, you know, give me a directory, they'd tell me where the meeting was the next morning, if I needed to be picked up, if I had a place to live. I mean, they just did the deal. They just scooped me up. And I was just one of the fellows. There was a gang. I had people in my life again, because I've always been a social animal, but I was starving to death. I fought for people out there in the streets. And here I had found these people just open, no judgment, nobody could condemn me as much as I had condemned the private murder that I did to myself inside, constantly running over thousands of times the same incident. We call it pig wrestling in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I have a memory, it's called a barn. And for years, I would bring out one of the pigs, and the pig would say, "Dad," or the time I slapped my mother, or a thousand other pigs. And I'd bring that consciously out into the mud puddle in front of me, and I'd make a conscious decision to climb over the fence and get into that mud puddle and wrestle with it. And the pig just loved the attention. And then after a few minutes or whatever, it would evaporate, and the pig would go back into the barn waiting for its turn again tomorrow. And I would stand there just full of filth and shame and guilt. And the incident that I had slapped my mother once, and it took a half a second, but it was the thousands of hours of how I condemned myself that really did the damage. I mean, I had just convinced myself that I was junk, and that time a thousand different things that I had done over 20 years of drinking, and I had a barn full of pigs, and it was just and every one of them was just a 10-second incident, a slimy little piece of behavior, some moral thing that was just against my nature, which I didn't know, but I'd get up on the cross and I'd just crucify myself for hours and hours. It was just a silent murder inside. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I was hearing these people from the podium, and they would just tell their stories. And what I didn't know that I was bathing in honesty that I hadn't heard for so long. And I was being given the gift of human intimacy. It didn't dawn on me until years later, you know, that at the level from the podium when people were sharing their stories of experience, strength, and hope, or later on when I was able to sponsor people and listen to their fifth steps, that people would open up their soul and they would share their intimacy, human intimacy, at a level that's so open and so honest. What it does is it gives me accurate perception on where I'm at. And by 100 men and women who have done that for me, it's given me a pretty good, clear vision. I'm just human. I'm okay. I'm not worse. I'm not better. That I'm just in the human game, and it's just fine. And so anyway, to make the short story shorter, I got here in that environment, and, you know, I did the deal. You know, I got a sponsor, and I got a home group through the guidance of a sponsor. And also, without me, a lot of men and women, members of Alcoholics Anonymous who went before me, who defended the traditions in their home groups, and they kept outside issues outside, and they kept it solid, and they kept it strong, so that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with my drinking problem, I didn't have anybody stand up there and say, "My name is Al, and I have a problem watching television, or I'm a gambler, or I have a food problem, or a drug problem." You know, that I needed the pure message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and these people before me had maintained those traditions, and I've come to find out that my only responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous is to defend the traditions, and that the steps and the commitments and the H&I and teleservice and all those other service things that step off of my recovery. So I try to, in my home group and other groups, I try to remind us that we have these traditions that guide us, and it's very, very important. It's critical that we separate ourselves, because the thing that glues us together is identity. And this latest term I've heard, this is a new world recovery, meaning let's all heal under the same roof. We'll all die together. So it was through that identity of people's struggle with alcohol that gave me permission to say, if they could find a way out, then maybe I can. And I was introduced to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that was laid out for us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've never deviated from it. I've never read any outside literature on alcoholism or the solution of. I bet my life on this book. And what I found out through the process of the steps, and I went through all the steps, that in the 11th step, it says that what I have is a daily reprieve. And I asked myself, a daily reprieve from what? A 24-hour reprieve from what? And the answer to that is I have a one-day reprieve from the conditions of the first step, my inability to process alcohol and my inability to process life. Because when I found out that my problem was alcohol, that my symptom was alcohol, page 64 tells us that alcohol is just a symptom. And the reason that page 47 was resonated for me, it just made sense to me, because I'd fought booze and I had made every commitment to my... I remember when on my hands and knees holding my mother's apron when I was 36 years old, begging my mother, telling her that I'd quit drinking, and I was drunk the next day. And the reason was because the book explained it so clearly, that at certain times the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. And the reason why is because on 36 it says that with my good common sense, it says I have good common sense. I know I have trouble with drink. I know that when I drink I get in it. I understand that. I'm not wet-brained. I'm not unintelligent. The good Lord gave me intelligence, and I haven't maximized it, but what I had working for me, I recognized that I have common sense. I know I have trouble with booze, but what I didn't know, it says that what parallels this common sense is I have this sense of insanity. And as I'm walking down the street, from my common sense, I'll slip into an area of insanity. And I have no defense against that. And that insanity will tell me I can drink. And I'll believe it, like Jim on page 35. He's an alcoholic. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he goes back out there and he finds himself in a restaurant, and he slips into that insanity that says if he mixed a little whiskey and milk together, he'd be okay. And he bought that. So that was my problem, you know. I knew I had trouble with booze, but I would slip into this insanity. And the second step proposal was that I would come to believe that some power greater than myself would restore me to sanity before I picked up the drink. That was an amazing revelation for me. What that told me was that as an alcoholic, I was being given something that I had prayed for years, and that was to have choice when it came to alcohol. The alcoholic doesn't have a choice. The social drinker has choice. The alcoholic does not have a choice. So that started to put my attention into the book, that it knows what it's talking about. These drunks who wrote this book have been there and found the way out. And if I do what they do, I'll get what they got. And that the unmanageability of my life, you know, was not my circumstances. I hear people talk about the definition of unmanageability, and they say, yeah, I lost my job, and I lost my house, and I lost my kids. Those are my circumstances of my life. Those are the outside things. My life is from the skin in. It's who I am. So what it means is that when I go out onto God's green earth, and I stand up there, and I look up, and I say, I don't know what it is, but no matter how I approach this thing called life, it doesn't seem that I'm able to attain any peace of mind, or I'm irritable, restless, and discontented, and I haven't got this serenity, which I find out is the goal in life, that the person with the most serenity wins. And I come from a society that tells me the person with the most toys wins. And that serenity can't be done with intellectual powers alone. You know, our forebearers, the Oxford people that we came out of, who helped us so much in the very beginning, they used to have slogans like we have slogans in AA. We say one day at a time, and easy does it, and all that. And they used to say, are you maximum? Are you maximum today? And what that meant was, have you done your prayer and meditation today, where you have engaged your mental processing and facility with your spiritual abilities, and you have put those together so that you can go out into the world with maximum human potential? Or are you just going out there intellectually, which is self-will run riot, which is the definition of self-centeredness, just intellectual, cerebral only? And I've come to find out that through this process of the 12 steps, the 12 steps says, by the way, it says that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of taking these steps, it doesn't say having had an intellectual awakening or a cerebral awakening. It says to wake up the spirit. And so back to the first step where it says that I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. And the solution to that dilemma is to awaken the spirit by taking these steps. So I did that. And the steps, when I made the third step decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God that I met in the second step, who was going to be my defense against the first drink, the question I had to my sponsor was, how do you turn the will and your life over to God's care? I mean, what's the mechanics of it? I don't understand. And he says, 4 through 9. He says, 4 through 9, that's the mechanism. That evokes the transformation, a metamorphosis from self-centeredness into the world of the Spirit. And I did those things, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I found out through the gift of introspection and confession and willingness and humility and brotherly love and restitution that I earned my way into page 84, 10th step, that says, for now we have entered the world of the Spirit. I'm in. Because Bill promised when he wrote this book, the metaphor he used was a rocket ship. And he used that metaphor because they were building the World's Fair in New York in 1934, the same time he was putting this book together. And that World's Fair was about Futurama. And there was some space travel in there. And that was new, and people were excited about that. And Bill, he was in New York at the time, and Madison Avenue was pumping up this World's Fair because they needed 60,000 people to pay for the damn thing. And so they had a lot of hype going on, and Bill was in that envelope of hype, and he liked that rocketry idea. So he said, we'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension. And that fourth dimension is the world of the Spirit, page 84. So on page 25, he says, you're going to be rocketed to some destination, and that destination is the arrival place, is page 84. We're going to be rocketed into a fourth dimension that we never dreamed existed, which is the world of the Spirit. People call the American Indians here, I think, call it the 10-inch journey. People call it the 2-foot drop. I got to get out of my head, and I have to get into my spirit. And in the context of the Western world here, we talk about the soul residing in our heart, and there resides this idea of the higher power. And so I did the work, which is the first 83 pages, which gives me a spiritual discipline. The first 9 steps, the instructions on the first 9 steps, what it did was it gave me a spiritual discipline. And page 85, the 11th step, says that what I have is a one-day reprieve contingent upon the daily maintenance of my newfound spiritual conditions, which I now have. And then they lay it out there, pages 84 to 88. That is what I'm supposed to maintain on a daily basis. And what that does is that tells my mind how to think all through the day, to listen to the higher power for direction for that day. It's like on my roof, if my antenna gets blown up sideways, I got to go up there and I got to readjust my antenna so I get the signal out of my TV set. And it's the same thing. Every morning I have to readjust my antenna to listen for direction. People say, TK, you pray and meditate. I said, oh, yeah. They said, are you trying to get into Om and one with the universe? I said, hell no. I said, the universe is none of my business. I said, all I want is simple direction. I need direction, and I can't get it out of my head. My sponsor told me, he said, your brain is one organ in your body. And it's a fabulous, instrument. But what it can do, it can give you options, all kinds of options. But it doesn't know which one is the best direction for your life. He said, if you're trying to get direction from your life out of your brain, he said, you might as well ask your pancreas, for Christ's sake. You know, he said, you need direction from a power greater than yourself. So over time, I've tried to do that. Meanwhile, I'm doing the AA thing, and I got to get back into the world, and I got to get a job, and I got a job, and I worked there for 25 years, and I met a lady, and we got married. She was an AA lady. And she was intelligent, and she was bright, and she was helping everybody and sponsoring everybody, and she was beautiful, and they used to call us the Lady and the Tramp. And we raised 2 kids and bought the house. All of a sudden, I got the whole catastrophe, credit cards and checkbooks and cars and kids and houses and all that shit, all that stuff. Meanwhile, Susie and I, we love AA. That was the foundation of our existence. And we'd bring her wet drunks home. I still bring wet drunks home and throw them on the couch. And she was shaking out ladies, and I was shaking out guys. And she's sponsoring a bunch of ladies, and I'm sponsoring a bunch of guys, and still sponsoring a bunch of guys. And it was just wonderful. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful, and it still is. And then she suddenly died on Christmas Day in 1999. She got leukemia, and we didn't know it, and took her to the hospital, and she died 2 days later. And I'm not man enough to take that kind of an emotional hit. She was everything. We had 23 years together and raised a family and everything else, and never had a cross word, never had an argument because of this program. And it lifted us out of ourselves, and we were able to enjoy what my friend says. He says, you know, you guys had a marriage that was made in heaven that really worked on earth. And it was fabulous. And so there I was, and I was in my weakest moment in my sobriety was the day after she died. And I just did what I was taught to do. And I sat down in my little place where I meditate, and I went down to my higher power. I have a little visualization where I, Bill used a rocket ship, I used an escalator. And I used 9 escalators to get down to my higher power. And when I get off the 9th escalator, I walk into the world of spirit, my higher power is there. And I went running in there, and I said, Susie died. He says, I know. And he doesn't milk it and say, oh, poor boo-boo, you know. He says, let's get into solution. He says, did you do a 10-step? I says, yeah. He said, of your character defects, of selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, he said, which character defect do you see glaring here? I said, selfishness. He said, that's right. He said, what part of selfishness? I said, self-absorption and self-pity. He said, that's right. He said, good going, TK. He says, your character defects are like Vaseline on your glasses. And he says, when you're trying to make life's decisions based on what you think you see, he says, you're going to make inappropriate decisions because you can't see the problem clearly. He says, so you have to recognize the character defect that's in your way. And he said, what you've done, he said, you've gone through normal, healthy mourning, and you've passed self-centeredness, and you've gone down deep into yourself. And he says, you're trying to process this incident from a place of self-absorption and self-pity, and you will not make healthy decisions. He says, what can I do for you? I said, the second line says, I'm talking about page 84, 10th step. The first line says, continue to look for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And then it says, the next line says, we immediately ask God to remove this character defect. And I said, I'm asking you to remove this. He said, of course, I love you. And then it asked me to talk to somebody about it, and I called my sponsor, and I talked to my sponsor about my character defect around this, and then immediately turned my thoughts to others that I could help me. What this all means, you know. And then what I have done is I have found that this higher power dwells deep within me in the final analysis that is only there that it may be found. Page 55, it tells me that this higher power dwells deep within me. And I like the concept of a higher power as not an entity, but unconditional love. It's just pure love. That's all it is for me. It's just pure love. It's so loving it can't hate. It can't judge. It can't condemn. It just loves me, no matter what. And when I do the discipline that's required, pages 84 to 88, what it does, it keeps me in love. And when I'm in love, it's the most secure I can possibly be, where I'm not needy about money, and I'm not needy about who's the next woman who's going to fix me, or position, or attitude. And it keeps me in a state of serenity. And the book says that when I do this discipline, I'll be able to match calamity with serenity. Well, first I have to understand what serenity is in order to match calamity. So through my sobriety, I've had some calamities. I've had some losses. And even the calamity of success. You know, when you're unworthy and you're not entitled to have, that's a calamity. Because I've murdered myself from my own thinking that I have to match that with serenity. And I ask my higher power when I pause, when agitated all through the day, and he says, give it to me. So I don't have to entertain myself anymore by validating that I'm junk. Because I'm not. God don't make junk. And I'm reminded when I was 6 years old, and before I had gained any bias and prejudice and sickness and old ideas and old behaviors, and I used to go to the schoolyard, and I would join hands with my brothers and sisters, the Chinese kids and the black kids and the Mexican kids and the Indian kids and all of us, and we would play ring around the rosy and all fall down, and we would squeal and laugh and have a good time. And I asked myself, what happened to me? What happened to me? How did I get so ugly and so vain and so mean and so confused? Because I did it to myself. My childhood hasn't changed a bit, but I have. I love that mind because of this program. And through this program, what it's done is matured me mentally and emotionally and mostly spiritually. And I like to think that if I die tomorrow on the gutter from where I came from as a urine-stained wino, I'll be grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous basically for one thing, that it introduced me to the spiritual dimension that I have. Because it's the biggest part of who I am. And when I use my God-given brain and I do the proper discipline all through the day of learning how to remind myself how to pay attention for direction, and I can be a maximum human brain and I can bring myself into the world as a spiritual and intellectual soul, that I now have the tools to accomplish life where I'm not reactionary to it. And I have a degree of serenity that no matter what goes on around me, I'm okay. That old AA line, everything in my life ain't okay, but I am. Thanks to this program and you folks that showed me how. God bless and thank you.